This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Listen to more of Charlottesville's own public media at sevillepodcast.com. On March 13, 2009, Professor William Wolfe addressed the Society on the topic, Responsible Citizenship in a Technological Democracy.
The title of my remarks tonight is Responsible Citizenship in a Technological Democracy. And you'll see what that means as I go along. You know, the famous they say that where you stand depends on where you sit. That is, the positions that you take tend to be a function of the job you've got. Well, let me tell you about the last job I had by way of giving some context for the rest of the remarks that I'm about to make. There are academies of science, engineering, and medicine all around the world. They are mostly purely honorific societies. It is an honor to be elected to the Royal Society in London, or the Académie des Sciences in Paris. 1863, right smack dab in the middle of the Civil War, a group of about 50 Americans got together and decided we ought to have one of those honorific societies too. And so they created a what we now call a 501c3 not-for-profit corporation. They happened to incorporate in the District of Columbia, and as you will remember from your high school civics, until about 25 years ago, there was no city government in D.C. Federal government acted as the city government. So our articles of incorporation are actually a bill that passed through Congress and was signed by Abraham Lincoln, which is kind of neat. But what's really important is that somebody, and after 11 years of trying to find out who or why, somebody added about 40 words to what is otherwise a completely boilerplate corporate charter. And those 40 words, in effect, say that the Academy will advise the nation on issues of science and technology, do so whenever asked, and do it for free. For free has been interpreted to mean not for profit, which is a little bit different. But anyway. So I like to say that the academies are, by the way, there are three academies all part of the same corporate structure, the Academy of Sciences, the Academy of Engineering, and the Institute of Medicine. I like to say that the academies are congressionally chartered to be schizophrenic. We have two very different personalities. One is as an honorific organization, and the other is as an independent advisor to the nation on issues of science and technology. A couple of hundred times a year, somebody in the federal government, could be in Congress, could be in the White House, could be an executive branch agency, asks us a question. And we will assemble a panel of 10 to 20 people, depending on the subject, who will serve pro bono, who will have no conflicts of interest, and who will be literally the best experts there are in the country on whatever the subject matter is. They will study the subject for, on average, 18 months. We have had one study that we did in a month and it almost killed us. And we have had two studies going on for 50 years. But the average is 18 months, at the end of which they will write a report, typically a couple of hundred pages long, that is fact-based. We are not interested in people's opinions. That report will be peer-reviewed, very carefully vetted to make sure that it's accurate. And we produce one of those reports every working day. So, the message is, I spent 11 years sitting at the nexus of science, engineering, and public policy. And I have to tell you, it was not an entirely reassuring experience. The number of public policy issues that have a technical dimension is much larger than I would have ever expected. And the number of Americans who are capable of understanding that technological dimension is much smaller than I ever expected. I suppose it's a good thing that the academies exist to advise the nation on the technical dimensions, but time after time after time, and I'll give you some examples in just a minute, I found the country implementing bad policy. I mean bad public policy, because the technical dimensions of the issue were not understood. You all know that Thomas Jefferson founded the University of Virginia. What you may or may not have thought about is that he was extremely proud of having done that. It's one of only three things he lists on his tombstone. He doesn't happen to mention being president of the United States. And when asked why he was so proud of having founded the university, his answer, on many occasions, was because you can't have a democracy without an informed citizenry. If people cannot discuss the public policy issues of the day, you have to ask what it means to call yourself a democracy. And I'm afraid that is exactly the situation that we're in. So when I came back to the university, I was, my wife and I are both on the faculty here. We've been here for 21 years. 18 of those 21 years, one or the other of us had a full-time job in Washington. When I came back just about a year ago, after 11 years at the academy, I decided I was going to tilt that windmill, that I was going to create a course for undergraduate liberal arts majors that would teach those science and technology concepts that one needs to understand in order to intelligently discuss public policy. That course has the title of my talk tonight, Responsible Citizenship in a Technological Democracy. I'm teaching it for the third time this semester, and I'll keep doing it until I get it right. No equations, no math, no science prerequisites. It's the concepts behind the science that really matter. And I'll try and give you an example in just a minute. Well, in fact, let me do it now. Have any of you seen the documentary film, Who Killed the Electric Car? Nobody. Okay. Well, there was a documentary film released about 3 years ago with that title. It tells a story of the fact that in the face of some really horrendous air pollution, in the early 1990s, California, something called the California Air Resources Board, CARB, passed a rule saying that a certain percentage of the cars sold in California had to be zero emission, i.e. electric. General Motors built a car especially for that market, an electric car. It had some drawbacks. Battery technology is not as good as it is today, so it only had a range of 40 miles. And worse, it was took about 15 hours to recharge the battery. On the other hand, I have friends who had one, and they just loved it. It was sporty, it was peppy, it was quiet, and best of all, it emitted no noxious fumes. Strangely, after just a few years, the California Air Resources Board rescinded the regulation. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, General Motors didn't sell this car to anybody. They only leased it. And so when CARB rescinded the regulation, General Motors recalled all of these electric cars and shredded them. Okay? And the premise of the film, Who Killed the Electric Car, was basically that there had to be a conspiracy here. Maybe it was the oil companies, maybe it was the car companies, maybe it was somebody else, but there clearly had to be a conspiracy. What bothered me as a technologist is that nowhere in the film did anybody ask which is better for the environment, the gasoline car or the electric car. I think they didn't ask because it seemed so obvious. The electric car has no tailpipe, right? So it can't be emitting any noxious fumes. But to anybody who knows a little bit of technology, there should have been a couple of red flags. So here I'm going to give you two concepts that I believe that every one of you and every other educated, liberally educated person in the country needs to know. The first one is what we in engineering call systems. Okay? Systems are things made up of a group of components, sometimes called subsystems. You see, the electric car is not a standalone thing. It's part of a larger system, which includes, for example, making the electricity. The gasoline car is part of a larger system, which includes pumping and refining the gasoline. Burn this into your brain. There is no answer to the question, is A better than B, for any values of A and B, without looking at the system in which A and B are embedded. Okay? So we need to worry about how much oil do we burn in the tankers that bring crude oil to the United States? How much energy do we burn in the process of refining the oil? How much energy do we use in generating the electricity? How much energy do we lose in the transmission lines? So, first principle that I want every one of my students to understand is you can't ask the question, is A better than B, without considering the system in which A and B are embedded. No equations on that, right? It's just a relatively simple idea. The second thing they need to know a little bit about is the notion of energy. Energy is defined by physicists as the ability to do work. And energy comes in many forms. There's electrical energy in the plugs in the wall. Okay? And clearly, you plug your hairdryer in, and you can get work to happen. The fan blows, the heating element heats up, etc. Heat itself is a form of energy. You can use heat to boil water, to make steam, to run a steam engine, for example. There's chemical energy. Your battery is a device which stores energy in chemical form. Burnable things like coal contain chemical energy. So energy is the ability to do work. It comes in many forms. Those forms of energy can be converted from one to another. So a battery is a device for converting chemical energy into electrical energy to light up your flashlight. And then there's something called the second law of thermodynamics. Now, that probably sounds very threatening. But the version of the second law that I give my students is nothing works perfectly. Nothing. Okay? In particular, the process of converting energy from one form to another never works perfectly. You can't get 100% efficient conversion of energy from one form to another. If you pick up your battery charger after you've been recharging your MP3 player, you'll notice that the battery charger is a little bit warm. That's because the electrical energy in the wall is being converted to chemical energy in the battery, but it doesn't work perfectly, and the imperfect part is given off as heat. A gasoline engine in your car, in fact, converts only about 30 or 35% of the chemical energy in gasoline into moving your car. The other 65 or 70% is given off as heat. That's why your engine gets hot. Okay? Well, it's an important thing to know. In the gasoline car, there's only one conversion of energy. There's conversion of energy from the chemical energy in the gasoline or in the crude oil to begin with into kinetic energy or the motion of the car. Overall, counting everything, including shipping the gasoline or the crude oil, refining it, the overall process is about 25% efficient. That is 25% of the energy in the original crude oil actually winds up moving your car. The electric car system is a little bit different. We mostly make electricity by burning coal. So we change the chemical energy in the coal into heat energy, which makes steam, which we then use to rotate a big turbine. So you got, now you got kinetic energy. That, in turn, generates the electrical energy, which goes over the high-tension wires and eventually winds up in your garage. That electrical energy is then used to be converted to chemical energy in the battery on the car. And then the battery, the chemical energy in the battery is converted back into electrical energy, which then actually starts moving the car. The overall efficiency of that system is about 7%. 93% of the energy in the original coal is just given off as waste heat. Bottom line, the electric car system emits about 3.5 times the amount of CO2 that is given off by the gasoline car system. Electric cars, given the way that we currently generate electricity, are a really bad idea. Now, you probably thought they were a good idea, but they ain't. Now, if we were generating our electricity from either nuclear power or renewables, then the answer would be very different. We would be giving off zero CO2. But somehow, by focusing on the car rather than the overall system, our attention got diverted away from what the real problem really is, which is the fact that 75% of our electricity is generated from fossil fuels. Only about 5% is generated by renewables. I want to make it very clear. I'm not anti-electric car. I'm pro fix the real problem. Okay? So, that's just one example. I could give you many, many more. But I think I'm just about at the time where I'm supposed to start stopping. So I think I'll do that. The point is that I have... Well, let me tell you one more story. I had assumed when I came back that I was going to be able to steal this course. There are all sorts of physics for poets kinds of courses. And I just assumed that I was going to be able to adopt one of those, that was going to be a solution to my problem. Well, after looking at about, probably at least 20 texts, I found myself unsatisfied. They didn't seem right. And just about this time, a year ago, I had one of those aha moments when I suddenly realized why I was not being satisfied. And the answer is because most of them teach important science. And I'm teaching the science that's important to understand public policy. And they ain't the same lists. Okay? Um, I did have a very rewarding experience last fall. I happened across a NSF-funded study of people who had taken Physics for Poets and similar courses. And one of the questions on that survey was, would you consider taking another science course? And 6% said yes. 94% said no. So I raced into my classroom, grabbed a sheet of paper, wrote across the top of it, would you consider taking another course, and just built two columns where you could put a check mark, yes or no. Absolutely anonymous. I have no idea who answered what. And they didn't even know why I was asking the question. However, 14 out of 16 students said yes, they would consider it. And I claim, I don't know this, but I think the difference between the results I saw and the results that were reported in this NSF-funded survey is that what I'm teaching is really relevant to kids' lives. Okay? It's not an abstract set of facts. It is, rather, what you need to know in order to be a responsible citizen in a technological democracy. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Yes?
Well, thank you for your case study. You said, or in your case study, that you're pro-finding a solution to the problem. What is the most effective solution to solving our CO2 emission problem? And has your group done any studies on it?
Yeah, we've done many, many studies on it. Some very general, some very specific. One of the studies that I got started just before I left, and which I hope will produce a report very soon, is to simply assemble in one place all of the pros and all of the cons for all of the various proposals that have been made. Advocates for various approaches tend to emphasize the pros and forget about mentioning the cons. And so I just want something where if you come to me with a proposed solution, your T-Boone Pickens, okay, I can tell you it's not the simple story that he projects. So we've done lots of studies. Let me just give you my own personal opinion, which is that in the medium term, anything less than 50 years, and we've got to solve the CO2 problem in the next 50 years, or we'll go past the tipping point. And I think the potential for climate change is the most important problem facing humankind. Just going away. Whatever's number two doesn't matter. We could. Every once in a while, I get annoyed with environmental types who tend to use the phrase "we need to save the planet." Let me tell you, the planet's going to be here a billion years from now. Okay? It's only a question of whether life as we know it will be able to survive on that planet. So. You know, I just think it's incredibly important that we solve this problem and do it within the next 50 years. And I think there's really only one option to do it in that period of time, and that is nuclear. Okay? Give you another example from my course that I talked to the students about. We have no technology for storing electrical energy, okay? At least not in any quantity. And so any renewable solution that involves a variable, the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine, cannot be the backbone of the solution to the problem because we can't store it, can't store electricity for the time when the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing. Um, Let me take another question.
Professor Wolf, thank you again for coming. In your experience working in D.C., I'm sure you dealt with a lot of bureaucratic obstacles, if you will. What would you say is the most difficult part about putting policy in action with the lawmakers in Washington?
Well, let me say, first, I went to Washington about as cynical as one can be about our government and the people involved in it. I come back with quite a different attitude. I am convinced that most people at relatively senior levels of the government really want to do the right thing. And they work very hard to do it. Now, you don't always agree with them about what the right thing is, but I think, 95%, sure, there are some bad apples, but 95% work hard, are trying to do the right thing, and are very smart. I like some of them better than others. I happen to know almost everybody on the science and engineering side in the new Obama administration. I'm extremely pleased with that set of folks. I'm conflicted about the new Secretary of Energy, Steve Chu, Nobel laureate. Is the second really technically competent Secretary of Energy we've ever had. Unfortunately, the first one was his immediate predecessor, Sam Bodman. And Sam, I credit with single-handedly having reversed the Bush position on climate change. I mean, I would not have objected if I happened to know both Bob Gates and Sam. If there was only going to be one, I could have been happy with either one. So I guess I'm saying I can't answer your question because I don't agree with the premise. Okay? Yes, sir. Yeah, I'm a contrarian on this. There's a long story to this. I won't bore you with all of it, but common wisdom is embodied in something called the linear model. The notion that you first do basic research, then you do applied research, then you do product development, then you deliver product. And I do not agree with that. It's a story which academics love to tell because it says we're at the front end of the pipe. We do the basic research, so we're really important. But in point of fact, there are many, many, many cases where there was product before there was any basic research, and the basic research was undertaken in order to improve the product. There was no theory of aerodynamics when the Wright brothers flew their airplane. There was no theory of thermodynamics when Watt built the steam engine. Okay? It was rather that they built those products and they kind of knew that they didn't work as well as they maybe could. And so that became the motivation for actually doing the basic research. So I think it's a much more complicated thing than this linear model. And so I think it's not something where you set up a dichotomy between the two things.
thank you so much for coming to speak with us today. You spoke about many of the solutions to the CO2 problem, and I just want to ask you, what is your opinion of fuel cell vehicles in general, specifically cars or buses?
Okay. For those of you who don't know, fuel cells are a technology for converting hydrogen and oxygen into electrical current and water. Okay. Fuel cell technology for very large fuel cells is really pretty well understood and pretty efficient. So in fact, people have talked about the fact that maybe we want to have a fuel cell per household and use that as a way of generating electricity, at least for part of the day. And if you do that, that actually would allow you to store enough electricity that you could drive it off of solar cells or some other intermittent form of power. Fuel cells that are light enough to really power an automobile are still a technology being developed. Been working on them for a long time, at least 30 years, and we haven't got the optimal solution yet. I'm not a chemist, okay? And so I am reluctant to make a prediction on when we might get there, but we've been working for a long time and haven't gotten there yet. No, I'd like to hear your list, actually.
So, you know, there was a lot of controversy around Road Movie. I don't remember the title, but
Inconvenient Truth, right.
There's a lot of controversy over that. I was kind of curious to hear what you thought.
Gore does tend to overstate the case. And he uses some gimmicks that I think are quite effective, but probably also exacerbate that a little bit. On the other hand, he really caught people's attention. And as I said, I think climate change is the biggest problem facing humankind. And so I tend to be sitting in his camp a little bit. I'll take his exaggerations as opposed to the case with who killed the electric car, where you really are promoting a policy which is bad for the environment. Next. My objective in this course is to make my students intelligent recipients of information. I want to give them the questions that they should ask. I have no expectation whatsoever that they're going to turn into engineer's light and know all the answers. It's rather, what are the kinds of questions you ought to ask? Okay? If somebody is promoting A over B, you just need to know to ask, okay, what is the larger system in which A and B are embedded? And let's compare those, not just the gas car versus the electric car. And as I say, I think every educated, liberally educated person in a democracy needs to have that list of what I think of as the hip pocket questions. Well, there's a short list of things that ought to set off alarm bells. I don't mean to particularly pick on Republicans, but State of the Union speech, I believe in 2006, Bush talked about a hydrogen economy. Well, the academies did a study on what it's going to take. We got asked by Congress, what's it going to take to get from where we are to a hydrogen economy? And the fundamental answer was about six miracles. Okay? There was some more back there. Yeah. Yeah and no. I guess I'm a market-oriented guy, so I would tend to lean in that direction. On the other hand, one of the kind of bogus arguments that I have heard on more than one occasion is about how much cheaper it is to run your car on electricity than on gasoline. And it is. Electricity is much cheaper than gasoline. That's because coal is cheaper than gasoline. Okay? So unless you have some way of taking total costs into account, just letting the marketplace drive it is not the solution. Did I answer your question? I don't think it's an issue of figuring out how to do it. I think we know how to do that. It is rather that there are winners and losers in that game, and the losers fight very hard. Let's see. When I finally realized that I was not going to be able to use another text, one of the Physics for Poets kind of texts, I decided I had better be willing to write one myself. And so I am engaged in that. You will often hear faculty joke about reading one chapter ahead of where the students are. Well, I'm writing one chapter ahead of where the students are, and it's about killing me. But I have had two universities, as they say, want to consider franchising the course. They want to become the McDonald's of responsible citizenship. And we have just started to talk about the possibility of delivering this at the high school level. The material is not difficult. Okay? It really is not difficult. I don't want to criticize other courses, but I have a conceit. I have to admit this. The conceit is, I think I can explain any science concept to anybody without a science background, and they will understand it. At least they will understand it well enough to become functional. Now, I must admit, I therefore have a an offer out to my students. Tell me what you'd like me to explain, and I'll explain. And last semester, one of the students said, relativity. I really scrambled to do that one, let me tell you. Anyway. But, yeah, I'm starting to think about that. The content is still changing a fair amount. And so I'm a little reluctant to go too public too fast. The first two times I taught the course, I taught it as a university seminar, which, as I'm sure you know, has a limit of, I think, 16 or 18 students. And I did that so that I would limit the damage. This semester, I'm teaching it to 35. I'm not going to change the world 18 students at a time. And so I've got to figure out how to scale it up to larger classes. And that's kind of the trajectory I'm on at the moment. One more question, she said. Yes, sir. He's a good friend of mine.
And so without, you know, I'm more interested in the interview or if you could have a little more on top, what is it about Stephen Chu that you're...
Oh, I have no concerns about Stephen Chu. I just wanted to make the point that the guy who was his predecessor was a pretty good guy, too. Okay? He's a PhD chemical engineer from MIT. All right, well, thank you very much. You've been a very nice audience.